It started like a lot of stories from the 1950s. A regular guy living a regular life until something very irregular showed up at his front door. His name was Albert Bender. He ran a UFO newsletter out of his attic. Nothing crazy, just a few pages stapled together, sent to other weirdos who liked to read about flying saucers and spacemen. Back then, this stuff wasn't cool. You didn't wear alien shirts or binge documentaries. You were the guy nobody invited to barbecues. But Albert didn't care. He wanted the truth. He believed something was flying around up there, and he thought the government was hiding it. Then, one day, it stopped. No warning, no explanation. He just shut everything down. Told his readers he couldn't publish anymore. Said he'd been advised to stop digging. His tone was terrified. At first, people thought maybe he had a breakdown, or maybe he'd gotten bored. But the truth, or whatever this was way stranger. Because Albert claimed he got a visit from three men. They didn't knock like normal people. They just appeared inside the house, wearing black suits, black hats, and faces that didn't look quite right. Pale, hair slicked back, smiles like mannequins trying to pass for human. They didn't say much, at least not with their mouths. According to Bender, they talked to him in his head, told him to stop his research, that he was getting close, that some truths weren't meant to be known. When they left, he didn't just feel scared. He felt drained, sick, like something had crawled inside his chest and unplugged the lights. And the weirdest part, his friends started noticing it too. He wasn't the same after that night. He didn't act the same, didn't look the same. He stopped talking about flying saucers altogether. He barely talked at all. Whatever happened in that house, it stuck. Hey, if you're still here, it means you're not just here for the surface level stories. You're chasing something deeper, like we are. So please do me a favor, hit subscribe, because if we don't build this community, the algorithm isn't going to help us and no one's going to tell these stories at all. All right, onward. Let's get one thing straight. The men in black weren't cool. They didn't wear Ray-Bans. They didn't crack jokes. And they sure as hell weren't chasing aliens through New York traffic while rapping in the end credits. Before Hollywood turned them into secret agents with dry humor and shiny gadgets, they were something else entirely. They were terrifying. The real men in black didn't show up to help. They showed up to shut you up. Quietly, permanently in some cases. And the first person to meet them didn't get a slick memory wipe. He got a lifetime of fear. His name, as you've heard, was Albert Bender. He was just a guy with a newsletter. But that was enough. Because in 1953, Albert announced something bold. He said he figured it out. He'd cracked the UFO mystery. He was about to publish what he called the truth behind the flying saucers. That's when everything fell apart. He shut down his group, cut off contact, hid in his house like a man being watched, which, according to him, he was. He wouldn't say much, but when he finally did speak, he said three men in black suits told him to stop. Not asked, not warned, told. And here's where it gets weird. They didn't just threaten him. They made him sick. Bender said after they visited, he felt physically ill. Couldn't think straight. Couldn't sleep. He claimed they communicated with him telepathically. Not with words, with thoughts, images, with pressure. People, of course, laughed. They said he was paranoid, delusional. But then, more people started having the same experience. Different names, different towns, same suits, same behavior, same cold, inhuman vibe. This wasn't just some one-off encounter. It was the first ripple in what would become a tidal wave of whispered stories about men who appeared when people got too close to the truth, who asked questions that didn't make sense, who left the air colder when they walked out. We're not chasing campfire tales here. We're chasing a pattern, one that runs through government secrets, intimidation tactics, and maybe even something not entirely human. This isn't a movie. It's a memoir, a warning, and maybe a receipt. And the men who started it all would never speak clearly again. So what exactly happened to Albert Bender? The part most people know, the shutdown, the fear, the men in suits, was just the surface. What he really experienced that didn't come out until nearly a decade later in a strange little book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men. And the contents of that book are something else. By then, Bender wasn't running UFO groups anymore. He wasn't talking to other researchers. He was a ghost of his former self, physically depleted, emotionally hollow. But the book finally gave readers a peek behind the curtain, and it wasn't what anyone expected. He said the men in black weren't just government agents. They weren't even fully human. He described them as floating into his room. Their eyes glowed. Their skin was grayish. They smelled like sulfur. He said they spoke inside his mind, showing him visions of space, of destruction, of some terrible truth behind the UFO phenomena. He claimed they came from a secret base in Antarctica and were harvesting energy from humanity using flying saucers. So, okay, yeah, that's a lot. But here's what matters. His symptoms matched what would later become the standard trauma pattern for alien abductees. Sudden shutdown of activity, paranoia and isolation, loss of appetite, memory gaps, obsession with symbols, patterns, and coded messages, an intense fear of phones, radios, even TVs. He believed they were being used to monitor him. And this was the 1950s, before Roswell was declassified, before hypnosis-based regression was common, before alien abduction had a script. Albert Bender was the first draft, and if he made it up, he somehow nailed the psychological aftershock decades before it became a thing. And then another weird twist? He never really tried to monetize it. His book was short, hard to find, and barely sold. He didn't go on tour. He didn't cash in. If anything, he wanted it buried. Which begs the question, what did they show him? Every good myth has a storyteller. And in the case of the men in black, that guy was Gray Barker. If Bender was the match, Barker was the gasoline. In 1956, Barker published They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, a dramatic, spooky little paperback that took Bender's strange story and turned it into legend. This was the first time most of the public had even heard of the men in black. The way Barker told it, they weren't just government agents. They were phantom enforcers, shadows in suits. They showed up, they shut you up, and they vanished like smoke. The book freaked people out. It sold surprisingly well. UFO fans started trading their own stories, now using the term Men in Black, as if it had always been there. And just like that, the legend grew. But here's a twist most people don't know. Barker was probably full of it. Not all the way, but enough to make you wonder what his real game was. Private letters between Barker and fellow UFO writer James Moseley later revealed that Barker admitted to embellishing stories, sometimes inventing them entirely. They joked about it, mocked their own readers, even called Bender nuts behind his back. So why would he do that? Was he just in it for the attention? The money? While some people say yes, he was a classic small-town fame chaser. But other people aren't so sure. Because while Barker was writing about MIBs as paranormal figures, the CIA was actively running psychological operations through books, radio, and TV. That's not a conspiracy theory, that's documented history. In the 1970s, we learned about Operation Mockingbird, a real Cold War program where the CIA embedded agents inside the media to shape public perception, especially around things like communism, dissent, and yes, even UFOs. So ask yourself, what better way to control the narrative than to hijack a real event and bury it under layers of ridiculous? Turn something real into something laughable. Make the witnesses look crazy. Make the idea unpublishable in serious outlets. Give it just enough spice to make the public dismiss it. Does that sound familiar? Barker may not have been a disinformation agent in the official badge and clearance kind of way, but he played the role perfectly, whether he knew it or not. He didn't just keep the fire going. He made sure it would burn wild and out of control. He didn't just document the fear, he engineered it. By the late 1960s, the men in black weren't just a rumor anymore. They were a pattern. Different names, different places, same black suits, same weird behavior, and always the same timing, right before or right after someone tried to talk. So let's run the tape. Case 1, Dr. Herbert Hopkins. In 1976, Dr. Herbert Hopkins was working on a UFO abduction case in Maine. He was a respected doctor, not some late-night radio caller. One night, he got a phone call from someone claiming to be with a UFO research group. They asked if they could come by. Now here's the weird part. By the time he hung up the phone, the man was already at the door. Black suit, hat, super pale, no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes. Lips that looked painted on. The guy never blinked. And he didn't just act strange, he acted unprogrammed. He told Hopkins to destroy all his UFO research. Then he said, casually, "My energy is running low." Stood up like a wind-up toy and walked the hell out. Minutes later, his car vanished. There were no tire tracks, no lights, no sound, no nothing. Hopkins went back inside and realized his cassette tapes were wiped. His files were gone. His phone line started glitching. He never investigated UFOs again. Case number 2, Jack Robinson. In 1968, New Jersey UFO researcher Jack Robinson noticed something strange. Every morning, when he and his wife left their apartment, a man in black was standing across the street. Same guy, same spot, just staring at their door. At first, they thought it was a coincidence. Then the mail started disappearing. Their house looked rummaged through, and the man didn't blink. After weeks of this, their friend finally took a photo of the guy. The image still exists. Black suit, thin tie, dark fedora, standing next to a van. It's creepy in that we're being watched by a Cold War mannequin kind of way. Jack's wife said he stopped sleeping, started locking every door twice, and their research slowed down and eventually stopped altogether. The man was never identified. Case number 3, Paul Miller. Now this one's wild. In 1961, Paul Miller was driving home from a hunting trip in North Dakota when he saw a glowing object land in a field. He claims he fired at a strange figure that emerged. The next day, three men in black suits showed up at his office. They knew exactly what he'd seen. They knew the names of his friends. They warned him, politely, to never speak of it again. Paul hadn't told anyone, not even his boss. He says he never saw those men again. and never talked about the UFO until years later. Same script, different cast. Look at the pattern. Witnesses see something. Prepares to go public. MIBs appear, act just human enough to slip under the radar. They don't kill, they erase evidence, confidence, even memory. Then they vanish like smoke. These encounters weren't just odd, they were surgical, almost like cleanup crews. But here's the part that sticks. They never appeared when someone was lying, only when the truth was getting close. So far, we've been talking like these men in black are just guys in suits. Spooky dudes with weird manners in a bad habit of erasing your hard drive. But the deeper you dig, the stranger it gets. Because a lot of people who met them didn't walk away thinking that was the government. They walked away thinking that wasn't human. Let's start with John Keel, the guy who wrote The Mothman Prophecies. Keel investigated dozens of MIB cases across the 1960s and 70s, and after years of chasing them, interviewing witnesses, filing reports, looking for patterns, he landed on a chilling conclusion. They weren't people. They were something pretending to be people. He called them ultra-terrestrials, not alien from space, but beings from somewhere else. Maybe another dimension, maybe another layer of reality. Maybe something older than both. He noticed that they didn't move right, didn't talk right, didn't know how to be human. Witnesses described MIBs getting confused by basic stuff like forks, salt shakers, dollar bills. One woman said a man in black stared at her pen like it was a live grenade. Another said he asked what her lipstick tube was used for. They didn't blink, their voices were flat. Their skin looked too smooth. Some even said they seemed to be reading off a script, like an actor who didn't understand the words but had been told to say them anyway. Others swore they flickered like bad CGI, or didn't cast shadows in certain light, or showed up in places they physically couldn't have reached. In the weirdest part, they didn't just appear during UFO investigations. They showed up during high strangeness events of all kinds, paranormal cases, cryptid sightings, psychic experiments. It was like they were patrolling the borders of the weird. So now enter Jack's Valley. He was a respected scientist, UFO researcher, and the guy Close Encounters of the Third Kind was based on, and he has a theory. What if the men in black aren't things? What if they are responses? His idea? That there's a kind of feedback loop between belief and reality. That when enough people believe something strongly enough, reality responds. It manifests. In that case, the MIBs could be psychic projections, self-aware patterns created by mass fear, cultural myth, and maybe even intelligence itself. Now, that sounds nuts. Until you realize that's exactly what a tulpa is. A Tibetan mysticism, a tulpa is a thought form, something that starts as an idea but becomes real through beliefs and emotion. You don't summon it, you grow it. I created an entire video on the tulpa effect and the Philip experiment and how tulpas might have been used to create the Philip experiment. If MIBs are tulpas, they're not from space. They are from us, which makes them even scarier. So now let's go full meta. In the 1970s, sci-fi author Philip K. Dick, yeah, the guy who inspired Blade Runner, Minority Report, and The Matrix, started claiming he was getting messages from another intelligence. One of his ideas? That reality has leaks. That when people start noticing glitches or seeing too much truth, some kind of program corrects it. He called them reality maintenance workers, So what if the men in black aren't here to cover up UFOs, but to patch reality when someone stumbles into the source code? Everybody asks, who sent the men in black? But nobody asks, what triggers them? Because they don't knock on every door. Only the ones where the signal gets too loud. Where it's not about what you saw. Maybe it's about what seeing it does to the world. Alright, so maybe some of the men in black weren't glitchy holograms or cosmic cleanup crews. Maybe some of them were just guys, with badges and clearances and marching orders. Because here's the part that is confirmed. The US government, especially during the Cold War, absolutely impersonated Air Force personnel to scare people out of talking about UFOs. And no, that's not a theory. That's from actual declassified CIA files. From 1952 to 1969, the Air Force ran Project Blue Book, a semi-public UFO investigation program. But behind the scenes, it wasn't just data collection. It was damage control. According to FOIA released documents, several cases involved CIA or Air Force agents showing up at witnesses' homes, flashing fake credentials, and warning them to stay quiet. Sometimes they took evidence. Sometimes they just showed up to ask weird questions, then left without explanation. In one case, an officer impersonating a Blue Book rep interrogated a family who saw a saucer land in their backyard. They later found out nobody from Blue Book had been dispatched. This wasn't rare, it was protocol. Let's talk about Robert Richardson. In 1967, Richardson was driving in Toledo, Ohio, when a small object darted in front of his car. He hit it. Whatever it was vanished, but he found a small chunk of metal embedded in his grill. He turned the sample over to a local UFO group for analysis. Then came the knock. Two men showed up at his house in black suits. No names, no agency. They knew exactly what had happened. They asked for the metal back. Richardson told them it had already been sent to researchers. And they got angry. They said, if you want your wife to stay as pretty as she is, you'd better get that medal back. So let's pause on that for a second. That's not some vague warning about national security. That's mob talk. Richardson had told no one but his local UFO group and his wife. And yet, here they were, demanding evidence that hadn't been made public. That's not coincidence. That's surveillance. And once again, this wasn't a Hollywood script. This was filed testimony. It's part of public record. So now let's not get carried away. Some of the men in black were clearly just government agents running intimidation ops. But here's the thing. Those guys left footprints. They signed in, logged hours, drove regular cars. They could be traced eventually. The others, the ones who vanished, glitched, floated, flickered, didn't understand forks or time zones? Yeah, they weren't listed on any payroll. So maybe the real question isn't, did the government create the men in black? It's, how many of them did the government try to imitate? Because if even one of those weird, not quite human encounters was real, that means the intel agencies weren't leading the cover-up. They were chasing it. At some point, the men in black stopped being scary. They started being funny. Ray-Bans, Neuralizers, Will Smith cracking one-liners, and chasing aliens through the streets of Manhattan. By the time the credits rolled, the real story, the original fear, was buried under popcorn and box office numbers. But that wasn't an accident. Because right before Hollywood gave us the Men in Black movie in 1997, something else happened. The US government started loosening its grip on UFO secrecy. In 1994, the US Air Force finally released the Roswell Report, trying to shut down 50 years of speculation about the 1947 crash. Their conclusion? It wasn't aliens. It was a high-altitude balloon from Project Mogul, a secret nuclear surveillance program. People didn't really buy it, but that didn't matter. The conversation shifted. 3 years later, in 1997, the government dropped a second report. Case closed. Then, boom, the Men in Black movie drops that same summer. Coincidence? Maybe. Or maybe the best way to keep people from asking real questions about who's cleaning up UFO sightings is to make the cleanup crew adorable. This isn't a wild guess. It's standard operating procedure. The CIA was directly involved in the production of Contact in 1997. They advised on the X-Files. They had their fingerprints all over Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And yes, they've had a literal entertainment liaison office since 1996 to help shape narratives in TV and film. So think about that. You have a secretive agency with a long history of UFO involvement, helping write scripts during the exact years when the public was starting to wake up. And then, boom, they give us a Men in Black who can rap. Psychologically, that's brilliant. The original Men in Black were creepy, robotic, silent enforcers that made people physically ill and afraid to talk. Now, they're punchlines. You make memes about them. You dress like them for Halloween. You hear Men in Black and think about sunglasses and talking pugs, not missing files and missing people. And that's the whole point. Because once something's funny, it's no longer a threat. Once you laugh, you stop looking. That's how you bury a monster. Not in a hole, but in a joke. And here's the trick. If you want to hide something, you don't cover it up, no. You exaggerate it. You market it. You turn it into a product. The real Men in Black might have been terrifying, but now they're merch. And maybe that's the most effective psyop of all. So let's shift gears for a second. Because up until now, we've been talking about obscure researchers, scared witnesses, and old school UFO nerds. But in 2002, it happened to Dan Aykroyd. Yeah, Ghostbusters Dan. Blues Brothers. Saturday Night Live. Hollywood royalty. That Dan Aykroyd. What you probably didn't know, he's been obsessed with UFOs for decades. Like, not in a fun topic at parties kind of way. In a here's my 700-page dossier and copies of military radar logs kind of way. So when he got the green light to host a serious UFO investigation series for the Sci-Fi Channel, he went all in. He lined up real guests, military insiders, whistleblowers, former government contractors, even a guy who claimed to be on the inside of black budget UFO programs. The show was called Out There. And then it wasn't. Here's what Dan says happened. He was outside the studios, talking on the phone with Britney Spears of all people. She was asking him to be on SNL. Weird side note, but just roll with it. As he's talking, he suddenly feels someone watching him. He turns his head, and across the street stands a tall man in a black suit, hat, glasses, just standing there staring. Dan turns away for a second, just a blink, then looks back and the man is gone. No cab, no steps, no walking away, just gone. 30 minutes later, he's told the show has been shut down immediately. Canceled, archived, never aired, never released. No official reason was given. The studio said they were moving in another direction. But the footage was locked up, and nobody outside the network has seen it since. This happened in 2002, long before the New York Times wrote about Tic Tac UFOs. Long before the Pentagon casually admitted, yeah, we've been tracking things we can't explain. This was during the History Channel Golden Age, when everything paranormal had to be sandwiched between reruns of Ice Road Truckers and documentaries about Hitler. UFOs were still fringe, and a show featuring actual government insiders spilling secrets? That wasn't just risky TV, it was a problem. Some people say a producer pulled the plug. Others say the network got a call. Dan just says somebody didn't want it to come out. Dan has told this story multiple times, on interviews, in documentaries, even on Joe Rogan. And each time, he's calm, precise. He doesn't act like a guy selling a spooky tale. He acts like someone who saw something real and still doesn't quite understand why it mattered so much. And the weirdest part? He still believes the footage exists, that it's stored somewhere, that one day it might surface. But until then, we just have the story and the silence that followed it. Let's stop here for a moment, because by now we've gone deep. Mind control, interdimensional gatekeepers, CIA intimidation squads, missing tapes, canceled shows. But before we go any further, let's do what most channels don't. Let's check our footing. Let's talk about what we actually know, what holds up, what's flimsy, and what deserves a second look before we throw it in the crazy bin. First up, Albert Bender. His story's been laughed at, ridiculed, called delusional. But here's the thing, it's never been debunked. No one's proven he lied. No hoax was uncovered. No motive was ever found. And he never cashed in. In fact, he pretty much went silent for the rest of his life. Whatever happened to him, it was real to him. And it triggered a response pattern we'd see again and again. And the CIA? That part's not a theory. The idea that U.S. intelligence impersonated Air Force officers to scare UFO witnesses, that's confirmed. That's not speculation. It's in the FOIA drops. It's baked into Cold War psychological operations. The files are dry and bureaucratic, but the truth is right there in the margins. People were being watched. They were being silenced, and official resources were used to do it. So if you're wondering, would the government really do something like that? They already did, across decades and continents. MIB witnesses described the same traits. Robotic movements, strange questions, inability to understand normal human behavior, disappearances that make zero logistical sense, a cold, draining presence that leaves them physically sick. These people didn't know each other. Many never even read Bender or Barker, and yet they tell the same story. So either they're all lying in exactly the same way, or they saw something real and eerily consistent. So now let's talk evidence. There's at least one known photo of an alleged MIB. The man who stood across from Jack Robinson's apartment, watching for days. It's not grainy Bigfoot nonsense. It's not some blur with a shadow. It's a man in a black suit, thin tie, hat, dead stare, taken in broad daylight. And it looks exactly like what people were describing years before and years after. No one ever identified him. No one ever came forward. He wasn't a neighbor, wasn't a cop. He just stood there, watching, then vanished. So now, let's be honest. Not every MIB story holds up. Some sound like they were written after someone had one too many X-Files marathons. Others are so over the top, they basically scream, "Please publish me." And yes, Gray Barker definitely added fuel to the fire with stories that were, let's say, creatively optimized. But here's the mistake most people make. They assume if part of the myth is embellished, the whole thing must be fake. And that's lazy thinking. You can have lies sitting right next to the truth. And sometimes the truth is what the lies are trying to bury. So yeah, some people exaggerated, but others, they vanished. Or changed, or never spoke again. Maybe we've been thinking about them all wrong. We've spent this whole story trying to figure out who they are. Government agents, ultra-terrestrials, thought forms, disinfo psyops, reality janitors. But maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe they're not here to stop the truth or protect it. Maybe they're just part of what happens when you get too close. You hear about people who study UFOs, or dig into ancient tech, or claim they've seen something that shouldn't exist. And then they go quiet, or get sick, or drop out of the public eye. Not because they were silenced, because they were changed. In the Men in Black, maybe they're not enforcers. Maybe they're symptoms, like radiation sickness. You don't see the cause, you see what it does to you. They don't kick down doors, they don't make big threats, they just show up. Say something off, ask something strange, stand in a place they shouldn't be. And suddenly, you start questioning what's real. Not just the event, but yourself. Maybe they're not villains. Maybe they're not protectors. Maybe they're not even people. Maybe they're just what reality sends when you start peeling it open like bad wallpaper. A soft voice, a crooked smile, a polite request to stop digging. Not because you're in danger, but because you're not supposed to be here. And once you see them, you're never quite real again. This episode was one of the creepiest we've ever made, because the scariest monsters, they don't crawl, they don't fly, they wear suits. They smile politely, and they show up when no one's supposed to. If you made it this far, thank you. You're not just watching a show, you're helping investigate something most people never even question. If you'd like to help this channel survive the algorithm, please join the crew over at patreon.com/divergentfiles. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there. These investigations are powered by those who believe truth still matters. Thank you to our Patreon supporters. Join the mission at patreon.com/divergentfiles.